Hello, John Dennis here. It's Thursday, the 5th of March. Today, Gordon Brown appeals to the United States Senate to work together with Europe and save the world from economic depression and terrorism. But has he saved his own political skin?
We should have the confidence, America and Britain most of all, that we can seize the global opportunities ahead and make the future work for us.
Also today, for the first time, the International Criminal Court issues an arrest warrant for a sitting head of state. The president of Sudan is accused of crimes against humanity in Darfur.
There is talk of some demonstrations already in Khartoum, and that's certainly expected. Some will be spontaneous and some will be stage managed by the government.
And the architect Zaha Hadid on designing London's 2012 Olympics Aquatic Centre.
I don't think it's an issue of cost of one project. I think you have to kind of look at the whole Olympics together. You know, if for some reason we can't afford it, then I think we should have given it to France.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
Sandy Wars got the news.
The Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao has announced a massive government spending programme to combat the recession. In an address to Parliament, he said the coming year would be the most difficult of this century. He said spending would rise by 25% on infrastructure and social programmes. It would cost nearly $600 billion. The government of Sudan has expelled six aid agencies from the country, including Oxfam and Save the Children. This follows the decision by the International Criminal Court to issue an arrest warrant for the president on war crimes charges. The agencies say they were not involved in politics and hundreds of thousands of lives were now at risk in the country. We'll have more on Sudan later in Guardian Daily. The Venezuelan president, Hugo Chavez, has seized an American rice mill. He demanded they produce cheaper rice. The country's been coping with some food shortages this year. The president's threatened to take over the whole company. Here in Britain, the Bank of England is expected to cut interest rates again today to only 0.5%. It's also expected to start pumping new money into the economy to restart the flow of lending. The interest rate cut will mean a further cut in income for savers. The British Medical Association argues that England should abolish all prescription charges. Wales, Northern Ireland and Scotland have ended charges, and if England doesn't follow suit, it will be unfair, said the association. It made its case in a submission to a government review, saying charging people can be a disincentive to people taking their medicine. Gordon Brown's speech to the US Congress gets him onto the front pages of two of the morning's papers. There are big pictures in The Guardian and The Telegraph. Brown appeals for help to save the world, writes The Telegraph. Brown's call to US seize the moment to tackle world crisis is The Guardian's version. But he doesn't get a mention in the US press for his speech. We'll have a full report on Mr. Brown in Washington shortly. The Independent gives its lead to an interview with the Serious Fraud Office director, who says police have uncovered a spate of suspected frauds, and the Financial Times reports that Barclays is being questioned over funds at Lehman. It says the liquidators of the US bank are asking what happened to £2 billion being held by Barclays. And the two main red tops put the killer of Harry Potter film actor Robert Knox on their front pages. Let loose to kill, says the Mirror, claiming that police blunders led to the murder because Carl Bishop was allowed to roam free carrying several knives. The Sun calls him a knife maniac with its headline, I hope Rob's killer suffers, quoting the dead boy's mother. More on the day's news and breaking stories at guardian.co.uk.
The Prime Minister has urged America to seize the moment to tackle the financial crisis and sign up to his Global New Deal. Gordon Brown was only the fifth Prime Minister to be invited to address both houses of Congress. He followed in the footsteps of Winston Churchill, Clement Attlee, Margaret Thatcher and Tony Blair. It was billed as the speech of Brown's political career. So, did he rise to the occasion? The Guardian's columnist, Martin Kettle.
It's a speech to an American Congress, and so that audience requires a different kind of speech to the kind of speech you'd normally give to a British audience. And so it was Brown speaking in a rather different tone, very, very rhetorical, lots of adjectives and abstract nouns. It was very full of rather fulsome praise for America, which, you know, slightly sticks in people's throats over here and in Europe, but actually, you know, slips down a treat in the United States. That's what they expect from their guests to whom they've given this kind of honour. So, you know, he had to deliver in that way, and he did.
I come to this great capital of this great nation, an America renewed under a new president, to say that America's faith in the future has been, is, and always will be an inspiration to me and to the whole world.
What was his message?
Central message of the speech was not to go protectionist in solving the financial crisis. It was a multilateralist, global message saying, you know, we, together states and governments can solve this economic recession, can provide the finance that will get things moving again, but only by cooperating, only by working together on in a global framework, not by protectionism.
But should we succumb to a race to the bottom and to a protectionism that history tells us that in the end protects no one? No, we should have the confidence, America and Britain most of all, that we can seize the global opportunities ahead and make the future work for us.
United States Congress is historically very protectionist. You know, it's full of people who have their states or their congressional districts' interests uppermost in their minds. Of course they do. And, you know, what happens in Europe is not necessarily what's first on their mind. So, you know, it was quite a big message to bring, and it's not certain that it will be successful.
What's your assessment of the reception he received?
He got a very warm reception. Americans are very polite. They're very enthusiastic, you know, and Brown is a distinguished figure. And, you know, it's quite a big thing. There have been about 100 of these speeches by foreign leaders over many, many, many years. He's the fifth British Prime Minister to do it. That's a big honour to put him in the same bracket as Churchill, Attlee, Thatcher and Blair. You know, that's a big thing for him, a great moment for him in his career. And, you know, he obviously enjoyed it. He seemed quite at home there, I thought, in some ways.
Domestically, he's been under enormous pressure to apologise for his role in creating the conditions of this economic recession. He noticeably didn't apologise. Do you think that those calls will now go away?
They'll not go away. You're right, he didn't apologise. He said we've all learned lessons, but that was as far as it got. That's not exactly an apology in anybody's language. It certainly didn't go as far as Alistair Darling did yesterday in an interview with the Daily Telegraph, where he said that all politicians had to accept with some humility that they were contributed to the problem. Brown is not at ease doing that. It's not his style. He's a never apologise kind of politician. But he's also the Prime Minister, so he has to be pretty careful how he puts it. But I think the pressure from within the Labour Party, within the Cabinet, as well as from outside, from the government's enemies, from the Tories, is not going to stop. And I think he's going to have to find some form of words at some point fairly soon that enables him to then move on, say, yes, I didn't get everything right. Some things have gone wrong. But the question is, what we're doing now? And he needs to get through that door in order to have the conversation with the British people, I think.
And what's your assessment of the special relationship? And that was the phrase used both by Barack Obama and Gordon Brown during this visit. What's your assessment of the relationship now between America and Britain?
Well, you know, a lot of rubbish is talked about this, I think, John. I mean, look, it's an important relationship for both countries. The United States is easily the most important country in the Western world and probably the most important country in the whole world. Only China can rival it. Britain is not in that league. Britain is not a great power, but it's an important country, and that's what's often forgotten. So, you know, Britain's relationship with America is an important alliance for both countries, and both leaders know that.
You now have the most pro-American European leadership in living memory. It's a leadership that wants to cooperate more closely together in order to cooperate more closely with you. There is no old Europe, no new Europe. There is only your friend Europe.
But Obama, I think, does not want to be a character acting out a role scripted for him by Gordon Brown at the G20 conference in London next month. So he's keeping a little bit of distance here. He said some very nice words to Gordon Brown, which will have been greatly appreciated by the Prime Minister and his people. Nevertheless, he's kept his distance a bit. And as ever with Obama, he's very good at giving himself room to do things his way. He doesn't lock himself in, and that's a smart politician.
Martin Kettle, many thanks. And there's more analysis of Brown in Washington at guardian.co.uk/politics, including this week's Politics Weekly podcast with Jonathan Friedland and Jackie Ashley. Also on The Guardian's website today, it's time to get gardening. So says Jekka McVicker of Jekka's Herb Garden fame, and Jane Perrone's complete guide to planting flowers, shrubs, fruit and veg at guardian.co.uk/lifeandstyle/gardens. Christian Walmart expands on his letter in yesterday's Guardian, in which he explained how he dispensed with using toilet paper. Intrigued? You will be at guardian.co.uk/commentisfree. And are amateur beekeepers to blame for the bee plague? Asks our resident bee expert, Alison Benjamin, at guardian.co.uk/environment. The Sudanese president, Omar al-Bashir, has been charged with war crimes and crimes against humanity by the International Criminal Court at The Hague. Before the summons was issued, Omar told supporters at a rally that the ICC could eat its arrest warrant. But the ICC's charge sheet raises the possibility that Omar will be sidelined in Sudan, which will struggle to function with a pariah head of state. Zan Rice is in Nairobi.
He is alleged to have orchestrated the counterinsurgency campaign in Darfur, which began in 2003, and that campaign essentially targeted civilians in Darfur who were deemed supportive of rebel groups who had staged an uprising. He's now accused of seven charges of crimes against humanity and war crimes.
The ICC decided against the more contentious charge of genocide, though.
That's right. I mean, this was the most controversial of the charges and the most difficult to prove. The prosecutor, Luis Moreno Ocampo, had said that Bashir was personally involved in masterminding a strategy to wipe out three ethnic groups, the Fur, the Marsalit, and the Zagawa. But the judges in The Hague decided 2-1 that the evidence he presented did not support that charge at this stage.
What's been the response to this in Sudan?
Well, it's early days. I mean, there is talk of some demonstrations already in Khartoum, and that's certainly expected. Some will be spontaneous and some will be stage managed by the government. Bashir certainly hasn't got friends across Sudan, certainly not in Darfur and in the south. He's not a very popular figure. But there will be some who see this as an attempt to attack Sudan's sovereignty. The big question is how the government will react to this now. Will it clamp down on opposition groups? Will it perhaps target foreigners by expelling them from the country? Will there even be attacks perhaps on UN troops?
And he does have some support from other African states.
He does, African and Arab states. There are some who feel that the ICC perhaps has targeted, looked at African cases too much and not other abuses in the rest of the world. And that, this may harm the ongoing peace process in Darfur, which it has to be said isn't at a particularly advanced stage at the moment. But there was a feeling that, you know, by giving Bashir perhaps another 12-month stay, you know, he could be given a chance to see what he could do.
Zan Rice, well, a former soldier in the Sudanese army, has told The Guardian how he was ordered by the government to kill, rape and destroy villages. B. Kajabie describes the scene just before Sudanese army troops stormed a village in southern Darfur.
The commander gives us order to do everything. Kill them, destroy their villages, rape the women. This happened at the beginning of 2003. The attack would start at 6 in the morning and we would destroy the village. We don't leave anything behind. The government army would start the attack. Then the Janjaweed would follow on camels and horses back and chase those who managed to slip through the army cordon and seize any livestock. These orders came from above, and if we refused to do it, they would shoot us. At the end of the day, we are fighting our own people in our own country. This is why I had to abandon the army and the government and leave Sudan. This is what is happening in Sudan, but if you are not living there, you don't know it's happening. When they ask me to go on a second patrol, I refused to do it. They then accused me of knowing the rebel leaders and torture me for information. They would burn a tire and hang it from a tree so the hot rubber would drip on your body. I have got scars all over my body, on my back and on my legs. And you can also see where they hit me with the back of a rifle.
And there's a video of that interview at guardian.co.uk/Sudan. As the government in Islamabad investigates the latest terror attack on its soil and fights the Taliban insurgency on its northwestern border, the United States now regards Pakistan as a bigger security problem than Afghanistan. That's what Christopher Dell, the most senior US diplomat in Kabul, has told our diplomatic editor, Julian Borgia.
It has certainly made Islam a part of its political life, at least since the time of President Zia. It has made radical Islam a part of its political life. And so that's now seems to be a deeply ingrained element of its political culture that makes things there very hard. I think Afghans are very sort of religiously moderate, conservative, but tolerant in their views compared to some of the attitudes that are fairly widespread, it seems, in Pakistan. Again, this is from someone who's never set foot there, so I have to caveat all of this. And, you know, Pakistan is a, it just faces, I mean, it has a, such a huge population and has such economic problems right now. Of course, it has a long history of very troubled relations with India that complicate anything you try and do there. The extreme sensitivity there to the presence of, you know, foreign troops. Certainly, you know, everybody says, well, we're just going to the Fatah and clean out those nests. Well, you know, you could do that in theory, but you only create another problem with the backlash against the presence of American or other foreign soldiers. So there are no easy solutions in Pakistan. There's no silver bullet out there that we're going to discover suddenly one day and sort of make the problem go away. I think for all those reasons, it's a deep challenge. And yeah, I mean, probably harder than Afghanistan. You could debate that for hours quite inconclusively. But from where I sit, it sure looks like it's going to be a bigger problem. It is certainly one of those nuclear-armed countries, who, the instability of which is a bigger problem for the globe.
Christopher Dell talking to Julian Borgia. My name's John Dennis. Still to come in Guardian Daily, Richard Desmond, Stelios and Bill Wyman are among the guests at a gathering of philanthropists in London.
Last year, we raised 5 million euro over one night in Moscow.
And some of the poorest people in society prepare a garden for the Chelsea Flower Show.
We may have tickets to go to the Chelsea Flower Show, so we'll keep our fingers crossed and see how things go.
But first, the Aquatic Centre is the centrepiece of London's 2012 Olympics. It helped London win the bid, but it's been dogged by controversy, not least because it's gone way over budget. Its architect, Zaha Hadid, told The Guardian's Hannah Poole the idea behind the building.
Well, I mean, I think the original idea was, you know, because of this water and, you know, fluid lines, it was about, let's say, a wave, or in the beginning was two waves. But also we have been working with kind of organic morphology, you know, underwater life, all that sort of stuff. So it came from that research into kind of landscape and topography, and also because it was a pool and the diving boards and the diving pool, it was kind of in that way, you know. And the roof is kind of a wavy roof because we have an interest in how one can achieve a level of lightness and kind of, you know, roofs. And
were you very clear from the beginning that you wanted it to be a beautiful building?
Well, I mean, I think we strive for that. I think that, you know, an architecture, there is, and obviously functionality has to work in adjacencies in terms of these programs. Like, you know, you have to kind of have everything work together, like in this case, you know, changing rooms, the exercise pool from the, you know, the difference, the space between the diving and so on, and also how you access and how you move around the building, especially for the athletes, that they don't, you know, become cold and, you know, all the things have to be. And also at the same time, the diagram, the organizational diagram has to be very good in terms of function, but also you can deliver a great building and a very beautiful building.
There's been much made in the press about the fact that it's allegedly gone sort of three times over budget. Is that correct?
Without going on to that a lot, first of all, I think the original project was not including all the contingencies, all the fees, all these things. I think maybe now things will drop down. Because, you know, I think at the time, these things were priced, it was a very competitive global market. You know, the price of concrete and cement, the price of steel was, you know, high. So, you know, and I think that there are different pricing. There's one which is for construction and one which is the overall, you know, this includes everything. So they're not, you can't really mix and match them. People have to understand what it means. There's a construction budget and an overall budget.
So it's gone up, but you think it's probably going to come down again?
No, I don't know whether it's gone up or not, but I mean, I think there is a budget in it, and you know, these, you know, people have to develop these projects, and they then are priced.
Because of all the stuff, the fuss that was made about the cost, and then because of the fact that we're now in this sort of global recession, do you, in any sense, sort of wish that you designed a more modest building?
No, I mean, if they decided to do everything is a kind of in a box, and I think that, but also I think in these moments of recession, I think that uplifting the spirit is in a way even more important, and we should learn from things which were done in the past, which were done in a hurry or done because, I mean, people criticize social housing because it was done after the war and there was need for housing and they criticize it. This was done because of exactly these reasons, and they're, you know, I don't think it's an issue of, I mean, I don't think it's an issue of just a cost of one project. I think you have to kind of look at the whole Olympics together. And if for some reason we can't afford it, then I think we should have given it to France.
Zaha Hadid talking to Hannah Poole. The world's richest people should get a tax break to encourage them to give more to charity. That's the argument being presented at the Fortune Forum, which brings together 100 super rich people in the hope that they'll sign up to the campaign and give up some of their vast wealth to good causes. The Guardian's Robert Booth went to the philanthropy event at London's Dorchester Hotel.
On a wet and blustery night on London's Park Lane, there's few places that look as inviting as the Dorchester Hotel. And that's where I've come to attend, luckily enough, the Fortune Forum, which is a rather remarkable gathering of 100 super rich individuals, some celebrities, some models, and they're gathering to talk about philanthropy and what they can do for good causes. We should count ourselves somewhat lucky to be invited tonight. The organisers have told me that to really gain attendance, you need to be able to show a net worth of in the vicinity of $1 billion each. They're really trying to bring the very richest of the rich from around the world into one room. They're going to be entertained quite royally, from what I'm told. There's going to be a performance by the soul singer Joss Stone. Ted Turner, the billionaire founder of CNN, who donated money to the UN, will be in conversation with Carol Vorderman, of all people. Let's get out of the wind and go and have a look and find out what's going on inside. What's your name?
Hi, my name is Renu Mehta. I'm the founder of Fortune Forum, and thank you for coming along to the third Fortune Forum Summit.
Do you think at the moment, with the economy being what it is, it's going to be an uphill struggle for you?
Look, it is what it is. We are in, I don't think anyone will not be affected from this downturn. But let me say two things about this, the Metamilis proposal. The first is that it's allowing someone's money going further. And it's the right time to do this in the economic cycle, because it's actually encouraging people to give by making it simpler to give.
Can you just tell us who you are and what's brought you here?
I'm Ted Turner. I'm over here visiting, making some contacts, and I'm here for this dinner tonight for the Fortune Forum.
Ted, what differences do you see between philanthropy in the States and philanthropy as you see it over here?
Well, over here, I think in Europe, from all I've read, philanthropy is not quite as large as in the United States, individual philanthropy, because the governments do more.
And what have you done yourself in terms of philanthropy with your own wealth?
Well, I've given $1.5 billion away.
How did it feel giving it away?
I enjoyed it. Better than just sitting on it.
And with Bill Wyman, who's coming on to the Fortune Forum event. Bill, this is all about philanthropy. What's brought you along?
I'm coming in the dark and just going to see what happens and listen to everything. but my wife particularly wants to come.
Sure.
So I'm accompanying her.
I'm Natalia, and yes, I'm a model, I'm a mother, philanthropist, and a woman. I'm from Russia, and I guess I do Vogue, all sorts of Vogue, and I Guerlain, Calvin Klein.
I mean, obviously Russia has got a lot of rich people. We see them here in London. Do you feel that maybe they should give more?
Not so much anymore.
Well, maybe that's an issue, because has the market affected the wealth of Russians?
It did affect people a lot, and in fact it did affect my charity a lot. Suddenly it became more hard to raise funds to organize the events, and also we have to be careful of what lots we're selling, because people are not so easier anymore with pairing with their money. Last year we raised 5 million euro over one night in Moscow.
Okay, I'm here with Richard Desmond and Stelios from EasyJet, is I think the only way I can say it. Stelios, what brings you here?
Well, first of all, I think we all have a duty to give back to society, so yeah, that's my bit for tonight.
Yeah.
I've known Renault for years, and I've participated before. I've been a speaker at one of her events. You know, I was intrigued. There are always worthwhile people around, and you hear different points of view. I have to admit I was a little late in arriving, because I finished my business dinner first and came around 9:15.
Are you a philanthropist yourself?
I've started a program of giving back. Yeah, I have I do things around scholarships with universities I went to. Entrepreneurship and the environment. So, you know, in a small way.
Can I ask how much you're worth and how much you might give?
I have no idea how much I'm worth. I'm probably worth half what I was last year. But who cares? You know, it's only a way of keeping the score.
And what about giving?
I have this program that you can actually see every year of giving scholarships.
Sure. Richard, can I ask you the same thing? Because this is an event about philanthropy.
Yeah,
well, I mean, you're obviously a very rich man. We know that you give a lot. So can you just talk figures for us?
Well, we don't like to talk. We're very bashful on figures. But
why?
Why?
But not in America.
Because we are bashful on figures. We're British and we like to underplay. Especially Celius is very British.
So tell me about your own interest in being here.
Well, I think, you know, Ted Turner attracted me to come here. I didn't really know much about the charity. I'd heard about Fortune, and I really came here to see Ted Turner, you know, a legend at his own lunchtime. And I thought what he said was very good. His line about constipation, I think, was a great line. If you don't give, you get constipated.
What's your view of British philanthropy? Because I know you do give quite a lot. You've had a lot of publicity about building a Moorfields Eye Hospital extension. Clearly you donate a lot of your wealth. Do you feel that there's a kind of rich philanthropic culture in the UK, or do you think we're lagging behind somewhat?
I think it's the same old people that give. That's what I think.
Joss Stone entertaining rich people at the Dorchester in the company of The Guardian's Robert Booth. The Chelsea Flower Show is normally associated with posh frocks and corporate jollies, as well as the gardens, of course. But this year, some of the most vulnerable men and women in society, homeless people, recovering drug addicts, prisoners, and the long-term unemployed, are producing a garden for the show. The Guardian's Stephen Morris had a sneak preview of their work, courtesy of Howard Jones of the Eden Project in Cornwall.
What it means is a real catalyst for some of the programmes we're doing already. And we're working in partnership with a couple of government departments, committees and local government, and the Homes and Communities Agency, to deliver a story, effectively, through the metaphor of a major garden at Chelsea. The story is all around vulnerability, inclusion, and it could be you. So we're linking, the process which leads to the garden is far more important than the garden itself, because we're working with homeless hostels and organisations around the country that deal with vulnerability and exclusion. We're working with the prison service and a number of prisons who are involved in the growing. So the whole garden is created by people who are actually involved in the story.
We think of Chelsea as a very high society event almost. This is more earthy, isn't it?
It certainly is, and that is actually at the foremost of our mind. What we can't do is indulge in some sort of self-important piece of work, and we are deliberately going against the grain. We could pay £150,000, get a famous profile gardener to build it. He would then go off to a couple of nurseries in the UK who do this every year, pay them 50,000 quid each, and you'd get all the plants there on time to cost, and there's your Chelsea garden. This, obviously, is totally different. Everybody involved in the growing of this is an amateur. Most of them will have never touched a plant before in their lives. And as you can probably gather from our work here today, that this is a totally new venture for everyone involved.
Just give me your name, would you?
John Gilmore. My name is John Gilmore.
And yeah. John, what are you up to here?
This is preparing a wall for a wall of plants for the Chelsea Flower Show down in London, obviously, later in the year, quite a prestigious show. So these really are sections of the wall. They'll all fit together like a jigsaw in the end, you know. And, like you said, the majority of that's French parsley, but there's a few little other plants going in here, and it will fit together, and you'll get this lovely kind of patchwork quilt of colour eventually in the end. So, you know, that'll be, you know, super.
And you're clearly enjoying this.
Yeah, but you know, we've come, Helen and myself, we've come down today for as volunteers, you know, just from the Shekinah Mission down in Plymouth there, you know. And yeah, we're really loving it. You know, it's a day out, brightens you up. You know, and you can experience of something.
Are you enjoying yourself, Helen?
Yeah, I am. Yeah, it's very therapeutic.
Oh right, is it?
Touching the compost, and getting you out for the day is all helpful.
You're getting your hands a bit dirty there.
Yeah.
No problem. No, we just brush them afterwards. You know, we don't wear gloves like some. Some of them are wearing gloves, but it's too. You know, you haven't got that sensitivity, but you know, whereby you can plant them really nicely and quickly. You know,
and will you get to go up to the flower show?
Well,
when
hopefully,
it's on?
Yeah. It's not absolutely certain, but it's possible that we may have tickets to go to the Chelsea flower show. So we'll keep our fingers crossed and see how things go.
Stephen Morris reporting. Today's edition of Guardian Daily was produced by Phil Maynard and Tim Mabey. I'm John Dennis. Thank you for listening.